Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Kabbalah and Coffee. So one of the themes that we're going to speak about today is the duality or the interplay between kamos and echos. And I'm using Hebrew terms and some mystical terms as well. Kamos is quantity. Echos is quality. So you have this duality, this dual dynamic of quantity and quality. Sometimes, and they're very different. Quantity is just more of the same. You have one item, you have one apple, two apples, three apples, they're all apples. Quality means suddenly you're not dealing with an apple, you're dealing with an Android. Joking. You didn't see that coming, did you? Right, so you're dealing with a different type of quality, you're dealing with a totally different type of item. Quantity and quality. Usually when you add the quantity, it doesn't change the quality, but sometimes it does. For example, if you take 9 people, you don't have a minyan, you don't have a prayer quorum, you can't say certain blessings. But you add a 10th and suddenly, you got a minion. So it's not just one more person. It's a totally different characterization of a group. It's a totally different quality of this group that's getting together. So oftentimes, quantity does not make a difference. But sometimes, most of the time, I would say that quantity doesn't really make a difference. It's more of the same, but it's still the same thing. But sometimes, quantity does make a difference. There's a teaching in the Talmud that says that two people, so one person can lift a certain amount of weight, two people together can lift more than double that amount. Right? So you would think two people, if one person can lift, how many pounds is a person lifting? 100 pounds. 100 pounds. So two people you would think can lift 200 pounds. It's not true. Two people can lift 250 pounds or 300 pounds. Why? There's something about that sort of synthesis, that coming together of more than one person that creates a sum that is greater than the parts. This is what we're talking about today, about echos and kamos, the quality and quantity. That sometimes greater quantity can move the needle on the quality itself. Another example that I thought about that I wrote in the email is, in the preview email, is when it comes to music, for example. A musical composition is not just a bunch of notes, but it takes on another quality in its synthesis, right? David, you have a family of musicians, right? So it's not just a string of notes. 1, 2, 3. Oh, this has 10 notes, and now 20 notes, and now 50 notes, and now 100 notes. How many notes are in a symphony? Or in a lot. Different parts. But let's say even if you're playing it on one piece on a piano, if you're playing like Beethoven's 9th, how many notes do you think are in that whole thing?
Thousands.
But it's not just thousands. It's not just one note times 1,000. It's a totally different quality. It's a different echos. It's not just kamos, it's echos. It's not just quantity, it's quality. Once you hit a certain number, another way to look at it is with letters and words. The word the letters that spell the word dog, D-O-G, it's not just 3 letters, D-O-G. It suddenly means a dog, an animal. It means something beyond the composite of the individual parts. So the point is that there becomes a tipping point where you cease to talk about the subject in terms of numbers, and you begin to talk about the quality of what it is. It's not just something times 3, times 10, times 100, times 1,000. It becomes a totally different quality. Now, with that in mind, I want to jump to a handout that I prepared. Good morning, good morning. You made it through the marathon. Here you go. We're glad that you're here. So let's take a look at the handout. This is a handout that I prepared from the Talmud. And once it gets passed around, just put it strategically. We may have some folks that come in as the class rolls. The first, I have two Talmudic passages. And by the way, I love studying Talmud in the context of Sunday morning Kabbalah and coffee. Why? Because it's such a beautiful synthesis between the two dimensions of Torah. You have the halachic, the legal wisdom of the Talmud, coupled with the mystical soul of Kabbalah, and it's a beautiful thing. So let's begin with an excerpt.
Did I get that?
No worries. It's all good. All right, so let's begin. The first excerpt on the handout is from Tractate Chagiga. Good morning, welcome, welcome. Okay, so I'm going to read this inside. Vastness of space. Such an interesting teaching. Let's begin. Everyone's got the handout? Okay. Vastness of space. It is taught in a Braita. By the way, what is a Braita? A Braita is a work of Jewish law that was authored in the era of the Mishnah, but it didn't make the final edit of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was the editor of the Mishnah, so he took all of the teachings that were written down, and he basically cut a lot of stuff. He only put in core teachings that were very, very, I'm not going to say basic, that they're elementary, but they were very fundamental, very essential teachings. And the rest, he did not publish in the Mishnah, but these were also published in another work or published elsewhere, and they're known as the Braita. Braita means outside. It's kind of like Lahavdil, right? Not to compare directly, but if you have, let's say, a film, and you shoot 3 hours of cinematic material, but you need to get a movie that's an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes, so you have to cut half of it, so that's where the editor's post-production comes in. You're always shooting more than you need. You're always shooting more scenes and more dialogue and all, you know, so much more than what you actually need. So in this case, and not to directly compare, obviously, this is Torah and that's Hollywood, but with Torah, so you also have in the Mishnah, there are those teachings that made it into the Mishnah and those that kind of ended up on the cutting floor, so to speak, and the editing table. So that's what we call Braita. So it is taught in a Braita. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, "What response did the divine voice provide to that wicked man, Nebuchadnezzar, when he said, 'I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High,' thereby intending to rise to heaven?" So let me explain. Nebuchadnezzar was the leader of the Babylonian Empire. And he was the one that led the charge and destroyed the first temple, the Beit HaMikdash, the first holy temple built by King Solomon. It stood for 410 years and was then destroyed by the Babylonians. Again, the Babylonian leader was Nebuchadnezzar. He thought of himself as a god. Not a demigod, but as an actual, he thought he was God. That's straight up. You ever hear of they call it a Napoleon complex or God complex? Yeah. Right? What is the Napoleon complex? God complex, right?
Yeah.
By the way, I read that Napoleon wasn't even short. Did anybody else read this?
No.
I heard he was like 5'7".
That's short.
I'm saying it's not like he's typically depicted as like being super, super small. He was like, you know, whatever.
That was an average height for that.
Right. So his name in French was Le Petit. Wasn't it Le Petit Empereur or something like that? Something like that, right? Whatever. Listen, that's another class. Let's get back here. So Nebuchadnezzar had a Napoleon complex. No, he had a God complex. He thought he was God. So he said. So Isaiah quotes him as saying, "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. I will be like the Most High." He thought he was and would be God. A divine voice came and said to him. Now, I don't know if he heard this voice, but our sages in the Talmud and the Braita tell us that this is a response that came out from heaven to him. And it said the following: "Wicked man, son of a wicked man, descendant, follower of the ways of Nimrod the wicked, who causes the entire world to rebel against him during the time of his reign. That's all the preamble. So this is how the divine voice begins. O wicked one, basically, hear me out, or listen to the following. And here we go. How many are the years of man? 70 years. As it is stated, the span of our life is 70 years, or if we are strong, 80 years. King David writes that in Psalms. He says, how long does a person live? 70 years, 80 years. Okay, we know that the Torah says the max is 120. But I mean, typically, at least then, whatever, 70, 80 years. So he says, so the divine voice continues. Now, is there not from the earth to the firmament, that means the heavens, a walking distance of 500 years, and the thickness of the firmament itself is a walking distance of 500 years, and a similar distance exists between each and every one of the firmaments. In other words, the divine voice is trying to tell Nebuchadnezzar that although you think you're really strong and you're really mighty and you're really godlike, how long are you going to live? 70 years, 80 years? Do you know how vast the universe is? Do you know how much greater everything is than you? It's like, I like telling this joke, spotted in a subway, like kind of scrawled on the, written on the wall, God is dead, Nietzsche. And then the next one is, Nietzsche is dead, God, right? God is dead, sign Nietzsche. Nietzsche is dead, sign God. Nietzsche said, God is dead. Really? Nietzsche is, at this point, Nietzsche is dead. I mean, he's not alive. Nebuchadnezzar thought he was the Most High. He thought he was God. He's not around. He's not been around for 2,500 years. He's not around. But he's saying, like, I'm the greatest. I can do anything. And so the divine voice said, really? Really? How long are you going to live? Max 80 years? How great is from the earth to the heavens if you would walk? Not if you take a rocket. That's something else. Ask Elon Musk. He's got that figured out. But if, or ask NASA, to walk from the earth to the heavens is 500 years. The heavens itself is 500 years. And between every one of the heavens, there are 500-year distance between them. Now, I should tell you that in Judaism, we have a conception of there being seven heavens. You ever hear the expression, seventh heaven? Seventh heaven? It's like if something's really like amazing, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm in seventh heaven. So Judaism speaks of... Do they say that in French? Okay, how do they say it? Sounds so much better in French. Everything sounds better in French. So seventh heaven. So where does that come from? So if you look in older Jewish works, even the works of Maimonides, they speak about seven dimensions of the heavens. The lower heavens and then higher, higher, higher until you get to the seventh heaven, which is a very spiritual and lofty realm. Okay, so the Talmud is basically saying, look how vast the universe is and how vast all the heavens are. Let's continue. Third paragraph on this opening page. And above them, above all the firmaments, are the divine creatures. The angels don't exist until you get past all those firmaments. The feet of the divine chayot creatures. The chayot creatures. You know what a chaya is? What's a chaya? Chayot is plural for chaya. It's a chaya. Chai, we know, is life. But what's a chaya? Chaya means an animal. So there are certain angels that are called the divine animals. Why are they called animals? They're very emotional. Animals are typically marked by emotion and not intelligence. Now I know, there are animals that are more intelligent than others. But typically, when you look at... You go to a... game reserve in South Africa, Kruger National Park, and you observe from the comfort of your little Jeep there on the dusty roads, you observe a kill happening in the desert. You never see a hungry lion set his or her sights, probably her, I think the lionesses are the ones, I think the guys just sleep all day, but that's for another class, whatever. So you never see the lioness size up the prey, and very hungry, need to feed the family, and then start running change her mind and say, you know what, let's order some pizza. Never happened. I know that because they don't have the ability to order pizza. Nonetheless, there is a very strong sense in the wild of kill or be killed, and it operates a lot by instinct and what we would call emotion, even if it's not human emotion, but more instinct than just aggressive behavior. That's the way the animal kingdom typically works. Again, you have exceptions. There are smart animals. Dolphins, I think, are smart. Some of the monkeys, I know I'm like... There's chimpanzees and orangutans. I know there's different types, and I don't know which ones are the smartest, but I know some have intelligence. The point is, though, that animals are typically marked by emotion. So there are angels as well that are marked by emotion. They don't really understand God, but they know a good thing when they see it. And they're all excited about God. And they say, Kadosh, 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 holy, holy, holy. And they blow up. They incinerate themselves with their passion and their love. They get so excited about God that they burn themselves out of existence. The chayot. The seraphim. They're also the fiery angels. These are angels that are marked by emotion. So again, after you get past earth, and the atmosphere, and then the seven heavens or firmaments, then you start hitting divine creatures. And now, again, let's read this inside the second sentence of that third paragraph. The feet of the divine chayot creatures correspond in distance to all the firmaments. Do you know how many firmaments there were? Seven. And between each one was 500 years. And each one, the thickness was 500 years. So we have a lot of things times 500. And it says just the feet of the chayot are corresponding to that whole number, that total that we have until now, which is a very large number, right? The feet of the chayot correspond to the distance of all of them. The ankles of the chayot correspond to all of them. The shins of the chayot correspond to all of them. The knees of the chayot correspond to all of them. The thighs of the chayot correspond to all of them. The bodies of the ani chayot mos. No, that's a mistake. Of the chayot correspond to all of them. The necks of the chayot correspond to all of them. The heads of the chayot correspond to all of them. And the horns of the chayot correspond to all of them. So even in the lower, even when we speak of the lower angels, these are now angels. These are totally spiritual beings. By the way, very important to note, when we talk about the ankles and the shins and the knees and the thighs and the bodies and the necks and the heads and the horns of the chayot, it's not a literal thing. They're not literally these massive angelic creatures that are the size of the universe times whatever. That's not what we're talking about. It's a spiritual idea. It means that it's very high, it's very lofty, it's very distant, not just physically, but spiritually. If we think of 500 years distance as evoking, it says it would take 500 years of walking to get between Earth and the first firmament. What does that really mean? How do we know this? Has anybody walked it before? What it means is, on a deeper level, once we get to the spiritual realms, is that spiritually, these realms are so much greater, so much far removed from our physical environment that it's said to be a distance of tens of thousands of years of walking toward it. In other words, the point is, it's so spiritually removed and beyond our reality. That's really the point. So, the chayot, the lower angels, the emotive angels, the emotional angels, not the intellectual angels, not the ones that understand God, but the ones that respond emotionally to God, they are so above and beyond. And then, of course, the Talmud continues, above them is the throne of glory. That's God's throne, so to speak. Again, God is not sitting on a physical throne, but it's all about trying to give an image that we can sort of relate to. The feet of the throne of glory correspond to all of them. The throne of glory itself corresponds to all of them. And the living, almighty, lofty, exalted king dwells above them. Now, all of this, if you recall, is meant as a retort from the divine voice to Nebuchadnezzar. And you, Nebuchadnezzar, say, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. But the next verse states, yet you shall be brought down to the netherworld, to the uttermost parts of the pit. So Nebuchadnezzar, you think that you are so high, you are not so high. On the contrary, you will be brought down to the lowest of depths, to the netherworld, to the uttermost parts of the pit. In the course of this discussion, though, so we have, again, we have a rebuttal to Nebuchadnezzar's dreams of grandeur and his God complex, where God says, you got it all wrong. But in addition to that, we also have a little bit of an understanding about how lofty the spiritual realms are. And this comes into play in our discourse. Let's pass these around now. This comes into discussion as we go through our text, because what we've been talking about, thank you, what we've been discussing is how our actions below trigger a response above that is commensurate to our actions. And so on page number, let's find the page. On page number 58, on page 58, the discourse, this Kabbalistic text that we're studying, the book called The Art of Giving, it draws a parallel between our actions and the angels, the Chayut angels that we just spoke about, as follows. One thing that comes out from the Talmudic passage that we just discussed is that in addition to God being so beyond anything that we can relate to or measure, right? It's trying to push God so high and above. In addition to that, the point is that there are successively higher levels of spirituality. There's the lower heaven, there's the heaven above it, right? Level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are higher angels and different parts of higher angels and lower, higher, higher, higher. The point is there are different dimensions of spirituality and divine dimensions. There are different levels, different dimensions of that spiritual reality. Yeah?
Is that why when the description about the Hayot, that I didn't count the number of parts that were listed, but maybe there's seven parts, I don't know, but the idea is that just as there's seven heavens, there's multiple parts of the angels. Each one of those parts is another level.
Yeah, exactly. And take a look, how many are there? So there's feet, ankles, shins, knees, thighs, bodies, necks. That's seven. And then it has heads and horns, which are actually eight and nine. So there's even more than seven. So there's seven heavens, and then with the angels, you already have nine. Even within the Chayur angels, you have nine dimensions. So the Talmud is telling us, although the Talmud is not a Kabbalistic work, the Talmud is telling us about the nature of spiritual reality, and that is that there are many different dimensions, and it's not just static. It's not just, well, there's the physical plane and then the spiritual reality. It's not like that. Within the spirit, there's a magnitude of different dimensions and different spaces and areas. Okay, so with that in mind, let's get back to the direct discussion of our text. On 56 into 58, we're not going to read it back inside, we'll just review it outside. So on 56 into 58, what we discussed is that based on the action, the magnitude of our actions is the magnitude of the resultant spiritual effect above. In other words, the greater we open up ourselves to others, the greater the opening up of the heavens is to us. And so the deeper we reach inside ourselves to give to others, in the context of our discourse, we're talking about giving tzedakah. So the deeper we draw from within ourselves to give to others, in other words, it's almost like the more difficult it is, because we have to reach a deep place where we say, even though I'm not so comfortable with this, but I'm reaching deeply in to give. So the deeper we reach, the deeper our actions reach above. And then from above shines this great light upon us and upon the world at large. The example we've been using is a camera. So you have the shutter. You have, right, the lens is closed. And then when you push the button, when you push the shutter button, so it opens up, and suddenly light comes in, and then it closes again. every time we give tzedakah, we're opening up the lens to heaven. But the deeper we give, or the greater we give, the more we give from a deeper place within, the more light we draw from the deeper dimensions above. And that's exactly what he says on top of 58. That when we give, the more we give, and the deeper we give, the higher a source shines down upon us. The higher the source that shines down upon us. So if we give one, let's say $1, so we get the level, you know, level one of spirituality. If we give 10, we get level 10. If we give 100, we get level 100. And again, it's not exactly the numbers matching the numbers that we spoke about, but the point is, the more we give from within, the more we get from above, and the higher we get from above.
Is that giving monetarily, or...
So...
Or, because you could give away your summer until you
right.
have nothing, and you
right.
just wither away and die in a corner because you gave it all away.
Right.
Okay? That doesn't make sense either.
Correct. Right. So what's the where's the balance? So here's the thing. So the direct context of this text is talking about giving monetary tzedakah.
Okay.
Because we're talking about giving coins, smaller amounts, or larger amounts, etc. Okay. We're comparing and contrasting giving, let's say, $1 a day to charity, to tzedakah, over 100 days, okay. or giving every 100 days $100 on one day. We're comparing and contrasting. And so what we're saying is like this. Every time we give, we open up the lens between heaven and earth, and the light shines down upon us every time we give. But depending on how much we give is how wide the opening is and how deep the light from above will come down. Right? How lofty a light we're going to draw down through our actions. So, if we give $1 a day for 100 days, so every single day we're opening up that lens to heaven, the light is shining, and it's coming from level one. If every 100 days we give once, but when we give it's $100, let's say, so you only open up that lens once. So there's only one time that the light came down from above and pierced through that opening between heaven and earth. It only happened once in that 100 days. But that one time, oh boy, it was a big light, and it was from a very lofty place, from the level of triple digits, from the level of 100. So we're trying to compare and contrast. So what's better? Is it better to consistently open up the apertures of heaven, open up that lens, and every single day flood the world with light, although it's on a lower level? So that's quantity. So you have 100 times, but a lower level. Or is it better to only do it once, but to really give a big knack that one time? It would seem, where we are right now, as of last week and as we start this week, it would seem that quality is better than quantity. In other words, although if you do tzedakah $1 a day for 100 days, every single day you're opening up the heavens, but it's only the lower amount. And it would seem that there's an advantage of giving that big wallop once and bringing down that flood of light on a very very great extent. And to bolster this point, by the way, just so you know, spoiler alert, we're going to get to a place where we say there's a way to do both. We're going to get to that place. That's why I feel like I need to share that so that we know where we're headed, but let's go through process. So again, it would seem like quality is better than quantity, right? Who wants 100 times of low-level light pales in comparison to that one time of colossal light. That colossal light, that super powerful light is so much better than 100 instances of lower level light. And to bolster this idea, he cites another story of the Talmud about a fellow named Elazar ben Derdaya. And this is an unbelievable story, and I put the whole thing in the handout. So again, let's get back to the handout that I prepared. Page number 2. It's the second half. It's the back. Sorry, it's not page two. It's the second side of the first page where it says the power of teshuvah. So here we go. This is straight up from the Talmud. The Talmud discusses the story and it shares it as follows. They said about Rabbi Elazar ben Durdaya that he was so promiscuous that he did not leave one prostitute in the world with whom he did not engage in intimacy. Right? Okay. What understood? Okay. Once he heard that there was one prostitute in one of the cities overseas who would take a purse full of dinars as her payment, which was a lot of money. A whole wallet full of cash. He took a purse full of dinars and went and crossed seven rivers to reach her. He was very dedicated to his pursuits. Very dedicated. He's a soldier. He's like, I got it. You know, that's it. I have my thing that I got to do. When they were engaged in the matters to which they were accustomed, i.e. intimacy, she blew out air and said, just as this wind will not return to its place, so too Elazar ben Derdaya will not be accepted in repentance, even if he were to try to repent. She said, just like this breath will never go back inside, so too Elazar ben Derdaya is a lost cause. There is no hope for him. This statement, the Talmud says, deeply shocked Elazar ben Derdaya. And he went and sat between two mountains and hills and said, mountains and hills, pray for mercy on my behalf so that my repentance will be accepted. They said to him, before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we must pray for mercy on our own behalf. As it is stated, for the mountains may depart and the hills be removed. He said, so basically the mountains and hills were like, we don't have time to get your prayer request in. We're working on our own stuff. Don't call us, we'll call you. He said, heaven and earth, pray for mercy on my behalf. They said to him, before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we must pray for mercy on our own behalf, as it is stated, for the heavens shall vanish away like smoke, and the earth shall wax old like a garment. He said, sun and moon, pray for mercy on my behalf. They said to him, before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we must pray for mercy on our own behalf. As it is stated, then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed. In other words, even the heavenly, even these bodies also have what to work with, have what to work on with their relationship with God. He continues, he said, stars and constellations, pray for mercy on my behalf. They said to him, before we pray for mercy on your behalf, we must pray for mercy on our own behalf. As it is stated, all the hosts of heaven shall molder away. Elazar ben Derdaya said, clearly, the matter depends on nothing other than myself. In other words, he couldn't rely on anything else to help him. He said, it's up to me. He placed his head between his knees and cried loudly until his soul left his body. A divine voice emerged and said, Rabbi Elazar ben Derdaya is destined for life in the world to come. When Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was, I mentioned before, the editor of the Mishnah, when Rabbi Hanasi means the prince, Rabbi Yehuda the prince, when he heard this story of Elazar ben Derdaya, he wept and said, there is one who acquires his share in the world to come after many years of toil. Sorry, only after many years of toil. And there is one who acquires his share in the world to come in one moment. And Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi further says, not only are penitents accepted, but they are even called rabbi, as the divine voice referred to Elazar ben Derdaya as Rabbi Elazar ben Derdaya. Here we have the story. This is a very, very famous story in the Talmud of Elazar ben Derdaya. The point of the story is, he didn't start off as a rabbi. He started off as a fellow who was very much steeped in behavior that was maybe not so kosher. And then, in one moment of tshuva, in one moment of absolutely, in a sense, bitter. When I say bitter, I don't mean like anger, but I mean like really deep remorse and regret and tshuva. So his soul left his body. He died with that intensity and that yearning the regret and the remorse and all that actually it took his life. And the divine voice called out and said, indeed, he is destined. They called him rabbi, and he's destined for life in the world, for life in the world to come. So our text uses this as a proof text for a fascinating idea. And that is, imagine a tzaddik, someone who does the right thing every single day for 70 years. For 70 years, this person, this tzaddik, this righteous person, is doing, not necessarily the tzaddik of Tanya, the way Tanya describes the tzaddik, but a righteous person. The righteous person is doing the right thing every single day for 70 years. And then you have Elazar ben Derdaya. We don't know how old he was, but for many years, he was steeped in sin, as we read, or steeped in this, you know, immorality, whatever he was doing. And then in one moment, he turned his life around, and then his soul expired. Who do you think, we don't typically rank people, but who do you think exhibited more passion, more dedication, and caused a greater stir above? Who do you think? Elazar ben Derdaya. One second. How do I know this? You're right. How do I know this? Because the Talmud says elsewhere, and I didn't quote this because it's not much more than the quote itself, but the quote says, oh, Talmud Tractate Brachot. Tractate Brachot. In the place where Bali Teshuva stand, even perfect tzaddikim cannot stand there. Bali Teshuva are penitents, people that have turned their life around. In the place spiritually where they stand, the perfect tzaddik that never did anything wrong cannot approach that place. So who was greater? We typically don't rank people. It's not our job. It's not our thing to like, oh, this one's better. It's not like a top 20 or top 40 or top 100. It's not a thing. Nonetheless, the Talmud does have this statement. So if we were to say, who reached a higher level? Who reached a deeper level in their life, in their experience? Elazar ben Derdaya or the tzaddik? It's Elazar ben Derdaya. And the place where he stood, even the greatest tzaddikim couldn't stand there. And Rabbi Yehuda, who said, some people acquire the world to come over a lifetime of work, and some acquired in one moment, you could understand that two different ways. What are the two ways that you can understand that? Think about it. He says, some people acquire the world to come only after many years of toil. And here's one who acquires a share in the world to come in one moment. What are the two ways to understand that?
What is it? Quantitative and qualitative.
But also, how does he feel about it? Is he happy for him? Or is he a little bit...
jealous, maybe?
I don't want to attribute jealousy to this great rabbi, but maybe a little bit, you know, like... Not fair. Right. A little bit. It's a little, right? Right?
But it's easy. If all you know in your life is always good, you're doing the right thing.
Right. It's easy.
It's extremely.
So you're a perfect tzaddik, but did it ever touch your core? Did it ever challenge you to the core? It didn't. Maybe it didn't.
No. I
can say for myself, this is not... I grew up in a Chabad family, and I was raised to put on tefillin every single day, and from 2 months before my bar mitzvah, I put on tefillin every day, and it's a thing that I've been doing. Can I say that it's been a challenge for me? It's like brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
So it's consistent. We all have things in our lives, good things that we do, that it's not only we take for granted, but that are basically, it's by rote. We do it because we do it. Everyone has things that we do. Whether it's elements of being polite or prayer and meditation, or whether it's giving charity, whatever it is. There are certain things that everyone does that are good things that are absolutely by rote. So you're a tzaddik in that area, but you're a tzaddik. You're a tzaddik, but you're a tzaddik, right? You're a tzaddik because you're perfect, but you're a tzaddik also with that consistency that doesn't really challenge you in a deep way. Elazar ben Derdaya lived his life in a completely different way. And in one moment, he made a choice, or he realized that this was not who he wanted to be. And he needed to change everything, and he regretted his entire life up until then, or this part of his life until then, to the point that it affected him so deeply that he died. That's very, very difficult. And so when Rabbi Yehuda Anasi says some people acquire paradise, Gan Eden, the world, Olam Haba, you know, reward in the afterlife, some acquire it after years of steady effort, and some acquire it in one moment. There's two ways to understand it. One way is to say that they're equivalent. Oh, you do this path or that path. The other way is to say, I'm envious of this guy. Either because it's not fair, he took the easy way out, or envious because it's on a much higher level than what could be achieved otherwise. The passion of Elazar ben Derdaya, it's hard to replicate when you haven't tasted what he tasted, when you haven't experienced what he experienced. It's hard to have that depth. I mentioned this at another class at some point in time. It sounds very vague. I mentioned this recently, that a lot of great comedians that have depth to their work, if you look at their upbringing, they went through very difficult lives.
Oh, you can see that with a lot of people. I mean, musical artists.
Same thing.
You don't watch American Idol, and I try not to, but every story precedes this heartbreaking, gut-wrenching story,
right,
which has elevated me to this place.
And it's true. It's the pain that brings out a depth. And that depth produces beautiful things.
You mentioned this before with the cracking of an egg.
The cry loud, the lighting, and it's the rose that breaks through the earth. It's the flower, the growth that breaks through the difficult, the soil, that's the diamond, you know, that comes from the pressure. All of that, right? All of these wonderful analogies and parables and examples and metaphors that we have. But the bottom line is, Elazar ben Derdaya experienced. He became a rabbi. The Talmud calls him rabbi. He wasn't a rabbi. He didn't live his life as a rabbi. He died a rabbi. He didn't live his life as a rabbi. And it's an honorary title. It's not like he was learned in the heirs of Jewish law that typically would require one to, what would be required to be a rabbi. He got the honorary title of rabbi to signify the heights that he achieved through this one moment of tshuva. So typically this Talmud is used to bring out the idea that we should always realize that no matter what we've done, not even us, I mean, who, no matter what a person has done, there's always a chance to get back onto a good path. And it could take just a moment. You don't need a lifetime of work. It could take a moment. Now, he didn't live to see the completion of this. He died, but this is a very extreme situation.
So that begs the question, do you experience the fruits of this in heaven?
Yes. Yes. 100%. The question, I think the real question is, do you experience the fruits of this on earth? Or do you live, with that type of bitterness and regret, not bitterness of angerness, but that angst, if you will, that inner angst and dissatisfaction with where we've been. Does that ever go away? I don't know. But the point here is that the depth that's born, or the light that's born of such personal transformation, is so much greater than the light that's produced by steady goodness each and every day. And it may not sound fair. Somebody did the right thing. It's like the two kids, right? The one kid that always pays attention to the class and whatever. And then there's the other kid that goofs off and doesn't pay attention, doesn't work, and doesn't get good grades. And then they finally work hard and they get a good grade, and they will get much more attention than the kid. That's the way it is. You get more attention with the transformation. You get more. Whether it's right, whether it's wrong, it's just the way it is. There's a power that's unleashed through that, because it took hard work, it took effort, it took introspection. Hey, Nasib. So, the point is,
do you ever have to punish him?
It's a good kid.
So, Rabbi.
Yeah.
So, but in that moment of teshuvah, you know, it's funny when you said he died, his soul left his body.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that can also be more
metaphorical.
More metaphorical, that in that moment of teshuva, you know, you are out of your body and in a different
space. Yeah.
Yeah. And
I like that.
And maybe he didn't return.
Right.
But maybe the lesson is for others of us. that that is a sign that when you, if you do this, when you come back, you are at a different level.
Different place, yeah. I love it. Beautiful, 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 yeah. And so if we're measuring light, output of light, right, like wattage of light, the light produced by a tzaddik steady every single day is 50 watts, 60 watts. The light produced in this one moment by Elazar ben Dodaya, 1,000 watts. What the magnitude of light that he unleashed in that moment was incredible. Yeah.
Okay, so you have this one person who is good every day.
Yes.
And he is good to the people around him.
Yes.
And he makes their lives better.
Right.
And he spreads learning and joy and whatever you can spread.
Yeah.
The other guy is promiscuous, selfish.
Good for nothing, yeah.
You got it. And all of a sudden he has this transformation. It wipes out everything he ever did. Just does not seem there at all.
Yeah, it does.
Not,
it does. Yes, well, it does. I think that giving throughout your life, giving of yourself, has its rewards to you. You get something out of it. It makes you feel good. That is your reward, going through life, making yourself feel
good. Well, but you're presuming that it makes you feel good. Maybe you're doing it selflessly.
Okay, so it's not a matter so much of self-discipline, it's a matter of I'm giving to people, that's my reward because it makes me feel good. This guy is going through life, saying, yeah, self-gratification, man, I'm getting it. I'm, you know, it doesn't matter who I hurt, who I make feel bad. It doesn't matter because I'm feeling good. And then all of a sudden, he gets this, and it's different. It's a reality. This is what becomes more important to him than life, than himself.
So what? What about all those people he's hurt on the road to his reality?
That's
the issue is the depth of the teshuva. How deep that was, that's what reflects the magnitude of the happening.
By the way, you're both right. You're both right. There's an advantage to the steady and consistent goodness of the tzaddik. But in order of magnitude of depth, there's an advantage to this type of fellow. Now, that doesn't mean that this is the ideal path and that this is something that we should strive. But there's an advantage of each. The advantage of the steady light producer is that you have a person that steadily, as you put it very very well, and that is that this person is living life, doing goodness to those around him or her, is shining light, is a source of light and inspiration, and that is a great thing that this person can never achieve. The steadiness cannot be achieved in one moment, because by definition, that's not steadiness. 70 years, 50, 60, 70 years of good living and being good to those around you cannot be replicated in one moment. So, and to use a Hebrew phrase, yesh bazeh, masha ein bazeh. This one has qualities that that one doesn't have, but that one has qualities that this one doesn't have. In other words, each one has its pros and cons. And you might say that if you look at the whole picture, the pro of being a tzaddik consistently is much greater than whatever pro you can tell me about Elazar ben Dodaya. And that might be right. But what the Talmud is highlighting, what our discourse is highlighting here in Kabbalah, is that what is the pro? What is on the plus side of a fellow like Elazar ben Dodaya? In that moment, he unleashed within himself his soul in such a way that a tzaddik typically cannot reach, because he or she hasn't tasted such depths, cannot reach such low depths, therefore can't reach so deeply inside one's soul and unleash a light in heaven to such an extent. By the way, there were those that said, jokingly, or maybe not so jokingly, when the Talmud says, in the place that Bali Tshuva stand, tzaddikim can't stand, there are those that cynically said, why? Because it stinks so bad over there. That's why they can't stand there. You see what I mean? So there's also a cynical way of understanding that statement of the Talmud. Yeah, not because they're so high, but because it's, you know, it's... But again, to present the balanced picture, there is an incredible advantage of doing good consistently and shining that light in a consistent fashion. At the same time, there's an incredible value, incredible plus to, in that one moment, unleashing this transformative spirit and depth and light. So each one has advantage.
Who are we to judge?
Right. And so what the point here is that all bring it back to tzedakah, you have the same duality. You can give every single day. You can give a dollar a day and make a difference in a measured fashion. Every single day, do an act of kindness, do an act of goodness, you know, in a measured way. Or you can have done nothing for 99 days. And then that one day, you make a big splash. That's like Elazar ben Dardai. That's like this guy who lived his life, whatever, and then one day, a huge splash. So you would say, maybe this big gift, once in a while, this big gift is greater than the small, consistent gifts, just because it unleashes such power, such light, such awesomeness. You hope not.
I really hope not.
Why?
You know, I can understand, and yeah, granted, asking forgiveness after all of those years, yeah. But that's one big flash of light that comes and goes.
Easy come, easy go.
Yeah.
But look, in that moment though, you're right, easy come, easy go, and it doesn't have the history, etc. But in that moment, do we all agree that there's a certain depth and power and light that's just absolutely unleashed in that moment?
I don't know.
By the way, I love this discussion because there's even in our text, he's trying to balance both approaches. Which one is better? Is it better to give consistently? Is it better to give once in a while a larger amount? And it's literally, you can see, you have differing pieces. Every single comment here is right on point, and there's truth to everything that's being said. And I think it's a beautiful thing because it's the diversity of this conversation.
I don't think that most people can ever reach that level of teshuva.
Of Elazar ben Dardai, that, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Can I just say?
Which I think is what you were saying about the soul expiring. Yeah.
But on a complete, on the negative aspect,
yeah.
What came to me is 1,000, like, whatever the bombs are that aren't atomic bombs,
right.
Give off less power in the negative aspect than one
atomic bomb.
And
right.
So there's just no, you know, it's...
You just can't compare. It's
negative,
just the way it is, right.
And I think that's the parallel that we're talking about.
By the way, the Rebbe used nuclear energy and atomic energy in a few talks as an example for spiritual actions and whatever. So it's not a wholly negative, although the destruction of it is a negative thing, obviously. But the Rebbe used it as well as a parable, as an analogy. And yeah. So right, in other words, you could have a thousand smaller bombs and it won't touch the magnitude of one atomic bomb.
I think one thing that factors in, can't get my head wrapped around it completely, is that the person that's doing the negative and achieves the glory, if you will, you can't enter into this relationship saying, I'm going to be negative and I'm going to hurt people or other people so that I can get a greater impact.
And then I'll flip it, right.
You can't do that. Same with, to a certain extent, giving a dollar every day because I want something in return. It's not about the intent of the return. It's just
right.
The greater impact of what happens. If I go through my life living negatively all the time with the intention of becoming happy later on, it isn't going to work.
Right.
So therefore, why it's fair is because this person really is not, at the time, perhaps, knowledgeable of the negative intent or the negative destruction.
They haven't thought it all through. You're saying they're just in that moment unaware of...
Perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know.
I
Do you know it says that when Mashiach comes, Mashiach, the Messiah, when the Messiah comes, Mashiach, when the Messiah comes, it says tzaddikim will have to go through tshuva. Teshuva, repentance. A tzaddik, a perfect righteous person, will have to go through this process of repentance. So what does it mean for the perfect tzaddik? In other words, there's a certain level where we say that they did everything right, but then when you see the ultimate truth, you realize that even if it was right, it could have been better. So there's sort of that type of regret of not doing it as good as it maybe could have done. So even my point is, to answer your question, it is possible. Even a perfect tzaddik could have that transformation, but it's very difficult. It's easy, and it's like a pendulum, like a thing. The more you swing it one way, the more it goes the other way, right? Like the old tire swing. The higher you lift it one way, you let it go, it goes the other way. The further it goes the other way. So
fix something that's not broken per se. You can't improve upon something that's already.
It's hard for the tzaddik to stir that type of dissatisfaction with self and that type of inner angst and that type of yearning. It's almost like King David writes in Psalms, Tzam alecha nafshi, kam alecha basari, my soul is thirsty and my flesh is... He talks about being thirsty and yearning. And he says he's in a desert in a parched land and he's thirsty for God. And it says in Kafeng, and it says in Kabbalah, that it's because the soul feels that it's in a parched and dry land that it thirsts and yearns. It's precisely because it feels disconnected that it has the power. If you're in a place that has water and food, even if you didn't eat or drink, you're not so hungry or thirsty. But it's when you feel yourself disconnected or in a barren wasteland that stirs the thirst even more. It's hard for the tzaddik to fake it. It's hard for the tzaddik to fake being in a parched land when the tzaddik is always in the oasis of spirituality.
I just have one question.
Sure.
It seems like the basic premise here is that in order to feel the ultimate good, it has to emanate from bad. That you can't be good all your life and have... It just doesn't...
We're not trying... So I hear that perspective. And I should... Just clarify, that's not, I don't think that's the intention. The intention is not to glorify bad stuff and to say, this is the ticket to the greatest stuff is the bad stuff. That's not what we're trying to bring out. What we're trying to bring out is there are certain actions that are consistent that evoke a certain amount of steady light and goodness. And then there are certain actions, however we get there, it might be self, maybe a person can bring it out, maybe the tzaddik can somehow self-stir that. It might be possible, but there's certain times that there's a depth that's achieved and a light that's unleashed that far outweighs all of the steady light that was produced in an ordinary fashion. It's like a reunion with a child. So there's a steady, when you see a child consistently, so there's a steady love and a hug and a joy that you have. But then if there's a separation for a while, the child goes out of town to school or... You're out of town, whatever it is, and then you see them after a little while, there's that greater joy and excitement. It doesn't mean you love them more than if you saw them every day. It's not about the parent who hasn't seen their child in a month loves the child more than the parent that sees the child every day. But there's a greater expression or an unleashing of that love that just, it's hard to replicate on a daily basis. It's, right? That's maybe a simple analogy that we can apply. It's not so maybe just to take a little bit of the contrast off of it. It's not like one is greater and one is less, but there's a larger magnitude of that expression when you have that distance. Sandrine, you had you wanted to say something.
Sorry?
Did you want to say something?
No, sir, I was just thinking yeshiva student.
Yeah.
That can encourage to go wide. You can go wide because eventually... Because
you can come back. So the point, so I think this is what Jeff was saying before, that you can't intentionally go in saying, well, look, there's no upside of me being a tzaddik and doing the right thing. So I may be in yeshiva, but let me just take a break from this for a while. You know, go a little wild, and then I'll come back, and oh boy, I'll be like this Elazar ben Nedarya character. That is the danger, but I think that's not understanding the truth of what this is. It's not fully, you know, applying what it's saying here. What it's saying here is not advocating sin or negativity or living a bad life and an unaltruistic life. What it's saying is there are moments. Look, you and I, normal human beings, don't need to look for opportunities to mess up to then flip. We're not perfect. So we trip. And in the moments that we trip and we say the wrong, you know, even if you love someone very, very much and they're very close to you, you can catch yourself saying something hurtful to them. It happens. It happens. No matter how much you love someone, you can say something hurtful. The question is, what happens next? That hurtful statement can stir that hurtful statement that you said at a moment of, because you were tired or you were this or that, whatever it is, whatever excuses there are, that can stir an inner angst and dissatisfaction and bitterness of spirit and soul. How could I say that? How could I do that introspection and then unleash a greater love for this person than you would have had had you not said this thing? So there's an upside. It doesn't mean to go around hurting people that you love to get that, to achieve that upside. Like, what I'm saying is, like, most of us are not, right? None of us are perfect tzaddikim. So we're doing this anyway. Might as well achieve the upside, yeah.
There's a lot of ways to get there.
A lot of ways, right. There's a lot of ways to get there.
And you need all the ways.
And there's light produced of all of it. But again, what we're saying is there's the steady, consistent, by rote light, and then there's that once in a while fierce light that's produced. So which is greater? That's the tension that we're discussing right now. So let's pick it up. Let's pick it up inside.
What's hard to accept is that, you know, it's one thing that you can reach that light in spite of your life. You have a, you know, it's one thing. But to say that...
It's greater.
Right.
It's
not just...
It's not fair. I did everything right.
It's not just as easy.
Right, right. But I think the message is for us, because let's make it relevant, right? Let's make it applicable. Like I said before, kind of in passing, but let's focus on it for just a moment. Each of us are in certain ways a tzaddik. We each have things that we do well. You know, we all have things that we also need work on and improvement on, and that's fine. That's what makes us human. But there are things in which we're consistent. We're consistently good at. The message here is maybe not to be satisfied with that goodness. How do we challenge that status quo goodness to achieve a greater depth and bring it out? In other words, how to challenge it and say, you know what, it's been good, but maybe it's not good enough. Right? Whatever that means. However, that I kind of want to leave it open-ended and not like specify, because depending on what we're applying it to, it could mean something totally different. But challenging the way, even the good stuff, to bring out a greater depth. But there's an advantage to that greater depth than even in the consistent goodness that perhaps exists at a lower plane, if you will. So let's pick it up now on 58, last section where it says tzedakah. The same can be implied regarding tzedakah. Since with a single large contribution, spiritual energy flows from a far higher source as a result of giving an abundant donation, it is appropriate to state that this single large contribution surpasses multiple smaller ones. So, like the spiritual light that's unleashed by a fellow like Elazar ben Nedarya, so too, a single large contribution, that once in a while, large gift, where a person challenges themselves and gives to someone else in that moment of giving, and they give a lot, they give broadly and deeply, so that stirs a spiritual energy that evokes, that elicits from on high. a very lofty spiritual energy, and it's greater than the light and the depth, or the depth of light that is produced by consistent giving. So it would seem, based on this, that the large contribution surpasses multiple smaller ones. Indeed, let's continue, it is for this very reason that one who gives less than a tenth or a fifth to charity has not fulfilled the obligation of tzedakah, despite having given this lesser sum in multiple small amounts, since it is less than the required total amount. This clearly indicates the superiority of a single large contribution over multiple smaller ones that do not add up to the required amount, since, as explained above, a single large contribution elicits spiritual energy from a higher source more than that elicited by multiple donations. So, if you're giving a very small amount consistently, so it's only radiating a lower level of light, consistently, but that light, he says, it's theoretically possible that light doesn't even reach the threshold of the light that's required to constitute tzedakah giving. So it might be a very small light, and it's very low wattage, and it's shining on that level. It's kind of crackling and whatever, but it's not really hitting that threshold. Whereas if you gave one gift of much more, forget about the consistent, but if you pooled it all together and just gave that one gift, it would reach the level of the tzedakah threshold and produce a much greater light. So here we see that there's an advantage in the quality of that bigger contribution over the quality of the multiple smaller ones. And here we get to the question. This, however, raises a difficulty. Second paragraph on page 60. And here's the challenge. How can this be reconciled with the opinion of Rambam, with Maimonides, who infers from the Mishnah, which we'll talk about in a moment, that it is better that tzedakah be performed particularly in multiple contributions, namely, that giving 100 single coins on 100 occasions is superior and more worthy of a reward than giving them all at once. So we just established that it seems like giving the 100 bucks at once is greater because it's this greater light, like the light of the tshuva of Elazar ben Yehudaya. It's much greater light because we're challenging self and giving, and it's a big splash. So how does Maimonides tell us, in his interpretation of the Mishnah, which we'll read in the handout in a moment, how does Maimonides tell us, or why does he tell us, that it's better to spread out the contributions over many occasions and give less? It's a contradiction. If there's an advantage in the light of giving once, so why does Maimonides advocate giving multiple times? Let's continue in the discourse. While it is true that giving charity in many small amounts has the advantage of effecting multiple supreme unifications, in other words, bringing heaven down to earth and radiating the light from above to below many times, nevertheless, this elicits 100 individual unions from merely the lower single-digit levels. It's only God's light coming from a lower dimension into the world. Conversely, by donating 100 coins at one time, one evidently elicits from the level of, quote, 100. In other words, a higher spiritual plane. This is a far superior superior level, as discussed above. Why then, and this is the core question, why then is it better, as Maimonides says, for tzedakah to be performed in multiple contributions? After all, the effusion from the higher level of chesed elicited by a single large contribution would be lacking. In other words, if you follow Maimonides' advice and give 100 coins, not at once, but over 100 days or 100 occasions, you're going to be lacking the magnitude of light that you could have achieved had you given it all at once. Hey, Superman. Stay here for a few minutes, and then we're gonna help you. You wanna have a bagel or something? Okay, so you can sit right here. Okay, so Maimonides tells us that it's better to give 100 coins over 100 days. But we just learned here that the light that's produced giving those 100 at one time is far greater. So then we're gonna lose out if we follow Maimonides' advice. So what do we do? So here's the key. This is fantastic. Second to last paragraph on page 60. To reconcile, our sages said, and this is the opening line of our discourse, this was the foundation of this text that we're studying, Our sages say in the Talmud, each and every coin adds up to a large sum. Here we go. Let's explain. When one contributes 100 single coins, they all add up. And when the final coin is given, it is considered as if the entire amount of 100 coins was a single large contribution. As a result, the higher level of chesed, of divine light, is elicited just as if the 100 coins have been given all at once. The Talmud says, Kol pruta pruta, every single coin, mitzdarefet lecheshbon gadol, is combined into one large amount. So we asked at the beginning of this text, 40 pages ago, what does that mean? Why is God, like, why is that happening? Who needs it to be pulled together? And the answer is, it's a beautiful thing that is pulled together. Because now we have the advantage of both. We have the steady, consistent advantage of giving 101 coin a day. But what about the big light that's produced by giving it all at once? When you give the 100th coin, it's all pulled together and it constitutes one large sum. Make sense? Yes? So it's almost like God keeps the running tally. And then when it hits, remember we spoke about quantity and quality? So you're giving quantity, you're giving every single day, one a day. One, one, one. But the quantity, the quality is still one because you're giving only one each day. So one is still one. But when you hit 100, for example, he's just using this as an example. When you hit 100, the quality shifts. It's not like 10 people, it's 1 minyan now. It's not like you have 10 people gathered in a room. You have a minyan, and now you can say Kaddish, and you can say Baruch Hu, and you can say Kedusha, and you can repetition of the Amidah, and you can read the Torah. It's a different quality. So the moment you hit, in the example that he's giving, the moment you hit 100 coins, God has been counting. It's not like yesterday's coin is gone, and today is just one. Every day is just one. No. Until day 100. And on the 100th day, it's all tallied together. Past is not forgotten. It's all tallied together. And now it becomes a gift, not of one times 100, but of 100. And so you have both advantages. You gave every day, and the great light of 100, if you will, has been unleashed. Let's continue page 62. Top of 62. This is a profound quality unique to the gift of tzedakah. I'm changing the translation. This is a profound quality unique to the gift of tzedakah. Earlier contributions do not disappear. In other words, you would think when you give, what you gave yesterday is gone, and today is a new day. That's not the case. God compiles, God collects, and God does not forget. And so what you gave yesterday is added, what you're giving today is added to what you gave yesterday and to what you gave the day before, etc. And when one contributes in the brackets, and when one contributes repeatedly, they all add up. In this vein, let's continue. The Arizal, the great Kabbalistic master, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the founder of Luriana Kabbalah. So the Arizal interprets the verse, and the verse says like this. It's a verse from Psalms. And his righteousness endures forever. That's the verse. Righteousness, tzedakah, omedet lo'ad. Tzedakah, righteousness endures forever. What does that mean? The Arizal writes, the spiritual letter inscribed as a result of the mitzvah of tzedakah outlasts those letters inscribed as a result of other mitzvot. As a result, his righteousness endures forever. So the Arizal says that every time we do a mitzvah, we inscribe one letter. What does that mean? So in the footnote, you'll see, he says every mitzvah is associated with one of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So every time you do a mitzvah, it's like you're writing a letter somewhere. On a mystical, a spiritual ledger of letters, you're writing a letter. You're inscribing that one letter. Okay. He says the letter that's inscribed as a result of tzedakah never erases, never disappears. It outlasts every other mitzvah that we do. On a very basic level, we can say that it's because when you make an impact, when you give to someone's starving, someone's hungry, the gift that you give them with tzedakah, that gift makes such an impact that they'll never forget. In other words, the gift that you give, when you give to someone in need, has a much greater and lasting impact than other mitzvot that we might do. Right? It's not to put down other mitzvot. But lighting Shabbat candles, wrapping tefillin, these are great mitzvot. But when you give to someone in need, when you give tzedakah, you make a much more everlasting impact. And the Arizal says the spiritual letter never disappears. And the Talmud says that the amount never dissipates. And God always keeps that running tally. Let's continue and let's finish chapter 4. Rambam is therefore justified, back in the discourse, middle of page 62. Rambam, Maimonides, is therefore justified in preferring that tzedakah be performed in multiple contributions as opposed to a single contribution. Maimonides is the big advocate of giving $1 a day or one penny a day or one dime a day. He says, give consistently in smaller amounts. Why? Since in this way, besides the total amount being the same, both the quantitative benefit, the oft-repeated supernal union, as well as the qualitative benefit of eliciting from a far superior source are realized. You have both, you have the best of both worlds. You're giving every day, and you're giving the large amount. But I didn't give the large amount. Don't worry, God's working the magic. Give every day, but it's the smaller amount. I'm going to miss out on the big punch, on the positive, right? The big knack. God makes the knack for you. You give every day, and God will pack the wallop. God will bring it all together. Given, let's continue middle of that paragraph, middle of 62. Given that each and every coin adds up to a large sum, as the Talmud says, the larger sum could be even 10,000. Eliciting divine energy from the level of supernal chafetz, as discussed earlier. In other words, forget 100. But if God is really counting up everything and nothing disappears, your tzedakah, even if it's for you, it's not present today, and even the recipient doesn't have it today physically, but God never forgets and it never disappears, what that means is, imagine over a lifetime the amount of giving that we do, and imagine how much that amount totals, and imagine what type of light that unleashes in the heavens. And it's an amazing thing. Let's continue. We can now understand why our sages found it necessary to state that each and every coin adds up. We asked before, at the beginning of the discourse, why does the Talmud even teach us this, that each and every coin adds up? Who cares? Who cares about the numbers? Is it a numbers game? Give each day, be a good person, be a kind person. Now we understand why. Because although it's good to be good every single day, it's also good to pack a wallop, to give a lot at once. There's a lot of light that happens through there. Therefore, the Talmud says, give every day and you won't lose out on the large amount either, because each and every coin adds up. So let's just finish the paragraph for 1 second. So we can now understand why our sages found it necessary to state each and every coin adds up, and how at the same time this conforms to the statement that everything is in accordance to the preponderance of good deeds, which means that it's better to do goodness multiple times than once. So do kindness, do tzedakah multiple times, do it every single day at a lower level, and the higher level, God adds up. And then he concludes with a parenthesis. Let's say, Sila Vushe Srad, laws of tzedakah, regarding how this method of charity should be put into practice. And this will be the most practical thing that perhaps you've heard all day from in this class. Footnote 113, we're going to read it together in a moment. Okay. Footnote 113, page 62. Everyone is obligated to hold steadfast to the quality of giving tzedakah. And listen to this. And keep a special pouch for tzedakah. Have like a coin wallet, like a bag or pouch for the tzedakah. The sages have explained that it is better to contribute to tzedakah in smaller amounts than to give a large one-time amount. It is therefore appropriate to place one coin into this tzedakah pouch on a consistent basis every hour until it all adds up to a large sum according to one's ability. All this should be done for the sake of heaven. And upon encountering a needy person, one should distribute tzedakah from the pouch. One way that we do this, you know, without carrying around a sack of heavy coins, perhaps, is by having a tzedakah box in our home, in our kitchen, in the dining room, in the office, and wherever. And throughout the day, certainly before prayer times, three times a day, you give a coin to tzedakah until it adds up. And then you bring it in, and then you give it as either to a place that distributes it to those in need or directly to someone in need. Bottom line is you're giving consistently and then you're also giving the larger amount. You actually have both. Let's continue. The divine service is for the sake of heaven, for thus did God establish in his world. Hence, performing a mitzvah causes instant pleasure in all the celestial worlds. And also for God, as it were. This is especially true in the case of tzedakah. Therefore, one whose only intent is for the sake of God's great name, not for any reward, would not want to donate two coins simultaneously, and certainly not more than two, for each individual donation causes pleasure on high, whether the donation was one penny or a single larger coin. Consequently, it is better to give one coin at a time than a number of coins together. He's saying literally in the pouch that you have for tzedakah, don't put two in at the same time. Put one in, and then a little bit later, put another one in. Because every time you do this, it causes God pleasure. So if it's about you and you want to feel like you're giving a lot, so then you'll give more than one. But if it's really about God, and God wants steady, consistent action, every time you give, it causes pleasure on high. So one, give one at a time until it adds up, and then you give it. However, this person should not assume, God forbid, that by giving 10 times one penny in one day, he has fulfilled his obligation of giving to tzedakah. On the contrary, if his means allow, he should increase his commitment to the mitzvah tzedakah with all his strength, giving more coins until they all add up to a large sum. The advantage here is that he is considered to be a constant giver of tzedakah, causes pleasure on high, and elicits divine beneficence again and again. You see what he's saying? Exactly what we said in the discourse. If you can give more than 10 cents a day, give more than 10 cents. If you can give more than 10 pennies a day throughout the day, then give more than that. But give consistently. Thus, the Levush Yisrael explains, so that was a quote. And now here's the editor's writing. Thus, the Levush Yisrael explains how the opening statement of our present discourse, that each and every coin adds up to a large sum, emphasizing the final quantity, conforms to the quotation from Avot that everything is in accordance to the preponderance of good deeds, regardless of the amount in each donation. So, give a penny, give a dime, give one coin, give it consistently throughout the day, let it collect, Give it to a good cause or to a needy person, and you'll have realized both objectives: steady giving and also a larger contribution. So this is, in summation, this is the message of today. There's an advantage in quantity and repeated giving. There's an advantage in quality. Who says you can't have your cake and eat it too? Who says you can't have the best of both worlds? Not Kabbalah and coffee, not today. You can have both. You can give consistently, and God gives you the quality as well. So, let us give, and let's give consistently, even if it's a penny a day, or a penny a few times a day. Just a penny. But give consistently. It's transformative for us, it's transformative for the other, and it's transformative for the world. Thank you very much for joining me this morning for Kabbalah and coins.